Poland and Russia, but it was explicitly modeled after the Western frontier. And Hitler was constantly making comparisons when he talked about Slavs or Jews to how the Americans had gunned down the Indians, which he was very impressed by. I'll share a few of his charming quotes. He said, "There is only one task, to set about the Germanization of the land by bringing in Germans and to regard the indigenous inhabitants as Indians." So it's pretty straightforward. Hitler said this in 1941. This was a direct parroting, of course, of the discourse of settler colonialism now brought back home to Europe.
You're listening to Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
On the right to lay claim to Ukraine's grain, Hitler once joked, we'll supply the Ukrainians with scarves, glass beads, and everything that colonial people like. I hope this makes clear that the Holocaust was not, as story one would have it, an event out of time, out of history. It was very much of its time and very inside the history of the 20th century. I just want to do a quick show of hands and ask you, how many of you learned any of this in school? Like, how many of you, when you had your Holocaust studies, learned that Hitler had studied the Western frontier, that he had studied Jim Crow laws? Did anybody learn this at school? All right, so we've got like six people about in a room of hundreds. And you seem to be younger people, if I may observe. I certainly did not learn about it in my Jewish day school in Montreal in the 1970s. I barely learned about the Indigenous genocide. Now, in Canada, that is changing and improving. My son, who's 11, learns about, for instance, from the cruel residential school system where Indigenous children were basically kidnapped from their homes and taken against their will to, as one Canadian official said, kill the Indian in the child. And so, you know, the students today learn about the unmarked graves where thousands of Indigenous children are buried on the grounds of these monstrous institutions. And they read books about how Indigenous children had to cut off their braids and were prevented from speaking their languages and practicing their ceremonies. But this knowledge is not connected, at least in the official curriculum, with what they are taught about the Holocaust or the longer arc of Jewish people being persecuted for practicing their religion and culture. Even in universities, Holocaust studies are largely cordoned off from genocide studies, from studies of enslavement and apartheid and racial capitalism and the study of settler colonialism. And I think this is part of why, since October 7th, so many of us have been talking past each other. We actually don't have a lot of experience talking to each other. These literatures are extremely siloed, and we are not familiar with each other's bodies of knowledge, I think scandalously so, and this is really revealing the cracks in this moment because we need to understand each other. We can't just have separate versions of how the world was born. This process of compartmentalization and not seeing the parallels is, of course, a great way to short-circuit possible solidarities, break apart coalitions before they begin. And it also points to the uncomfortable fact that white supremacist assumptions are even embedded in the wildly different and disparate ways that we remember and commemorate genocides. Germany, which prides itself on its memory culture and its willingness to make amends for the bloodiest parts of its past, waited until 2021, just 3 years ago, before recognizing the Nama and Herero genocide. And it still refuses to use the word reparations or compensation, unlike the Jewish genocide, which, as discussed, is Germany's Staatsräson, or making amends for it, which it equates with standing with Israel. In Germany's capital cities, there are no memorials to the Nama and Herero genocide, no museums either. One detail that I find really striking and kind of shattering is that the only museum devoted to documenting the genocide of the Nama and Herero is in Squamand, Namibia. So I've tried to give you the barest of glimpses at story two. I can't cover it. It's the history of the world. A long story of annihilating the other in the name of progress, civilization, and God's will. It doesn't actually begin in Europe's colonies, but inside Europe, in the Spanish Inquisition and the bloody expulsion of Jews and Muslims. As many historians have noted, it's striking that 1492, the year that Jews were officially expelled from Spain, is the same year that Christopher Columbus's ships set sail on their voyage of so-called discovery. Those ships unleashed centuries of this same logic, deploying that supposed God-given superiority to rid the land of infidels, now played out on vastly larger scales. But because these more sinister parts of the civilizing project were never reckoned with, never mind repaired, when the impulse to exterminate reemerged in Europe under the Nazis, very few people were able to recognize it as a homecoming, mistaking it instead for something wholly new, a kind of alien invasion. Now, this was not some kind of oversight. The failure to recognize these glaring continuities was a choice made by the powerful to protect their own interests, because to place the Nazi Holocaust inside a lineage of Holocausts would have forced a reckoning with history. It would have radically changed how we understand our national origins, how we make sense of the stark inequalities that scar our own societies and our world. It would have been revolutionary. So that story could not carry the day. Far more convenient to paint the Nazis as uniquely monstrous and arrogant and aberrant, and the Jewish people as hated in ways that cannot be compared to any other group. The dominance of this historical story has come at an extremely high cost. Because it fundamentally misconstrued who the Nazis were, forbade comparison, treated them like they emerged from outer space, barred the tracing of origins and genealogies, we cannot recognize the patterns, or many of us can't, when they recur. And of course, nowhere is the cost higher for these failures than in Palestine today. Many of Zionism's basic rationales were thinly veiled Judaizations of core Christian colonial concepts. Terra nullius became a land without a people for a people without a land. Manifest destiny became land bequeathed to the Jews by divine right. Taming the wild frontier became making the desert bloom. Civilizing or Christian Judaizing. There were notable differences in this doppelganger version of settler colonialism, however. Where European powers colonized from a position of strength and a claim to God-given superiority, the post-Holocaust Zionist claim to Palestine was based on the reverse, on Jewish victimization and vulnerability. Zionists were making at the time was that Jews had earned the right to an exception from the decolonial consensus, an exception born of their very recent extermination. The Zionist version of justice said to Western powers, if you could establish your empires and your settler colonial nations through ethnic cleansing, massacres, and land theft, then it is discrimination to say that we cannot. If you cleared your land of its indigenous inhabitants, or did so in your colonies, then it is anti-Semitic to say that we cannot. It was as if the quest for equality was being reframed, not as the right to be free from discrimination, but as the right to discriminate. Colonialism reframed as reparations for genocide. Except if Hitler had been inspired by settler colonialism in Africa and North America, including colonial genocides, and he clearly was, then this was anything but reparations. It was replication, a continuation of the colonial logic, but with broken and traumatized people let loose on a people even less powerful than themselves. Palestinians under this arrangement became, as the anti-colonial scholar Edward Said put it, the victims of the victims, or in the words of Joseph Massad, the new Jews. This, I think, explains many of the battles over words we have been having these past 6 months. These are all proxy battles for the underlying battle over how we understand the making of the modern world and where Israel and Palestine and even the climate crisis fit into that bloody story, hundreds of years long, a long arc of fascism. I'm going to wrap up here. I want to leave us, though, with a great prophetic voice, that of the Jewish-German philosopher Walter Benjamin. He wrote that there is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. He was inspired by the painting Angelus Novus by his friend Paul Klee. Benjamin saw a universe in this figure, and he shared his vision in the 1940 essay, Theses on the Philosophy of History. The painting, Benjamin wrote, shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring, his mouth is open, his wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But the storm is blowing from paradise. This storm is what we call progress. Benjamin took his own life that same year in a seaside Catalan town, unable to escape the fascists. So this really is his last wish for us, that we stop seeing history as a chain of singular disconnected events and crises, but rather grasp the one single catastrophe which unceasingly piles rubble on top of rubble, a past that turns the future into a storm we call progress. So where are we now? 8.5 decades after he made that plea. Very deep in the wreckage. Huge parts of our world lie in rubble. No cleanup crew is on the way. And nothing about this is metaphorical. Not the rubble, not the piles of bodies, not even the storm that Benjamin invoked. In the name of progress, the underworld has been disinterred and deposited in the sky, unleashing the uncontrollable storms of the climate breakdown. It is why leaders like Colombia's Gustavo Petro fear that in Gaza they are seeing a glimpse of the future for the entire global south. But something is shifting. Benjamin's angel wanted to awaken the dead, but he could not, not then. But today, the dead are awakening. We see it in South Africa's case before the ICJ. It is about saving lives and stopping genocide in Gaza. And it has also become an occasion for that suppressed story about the birth of the modern world to finally be told on the world stage, a long-delayed rendezvous with history. When Germany announced that it was siding with Israel in the case, the government of Namibia stepped forward to say, if Germany has not yet atoned for its genocide in Namibia, the first genocide of the 20th century, perhaps it should stop positioning itself as an expert on how to prevent genocides in the present day. Nicaragua, meanwhile, has launched its own case at the ICJ accusing Germany of aiding genocide with its weapons shipments to Israel. And Nicaragua, of course, has its own bloody history of colonial massacres. The courtroom is always a classroom, but I don't recall a time when so many lessons have been taught simultaneously. It is as if by naming Israel's Gaza onslaught as a colonial genocide, in the lineage of previous colonial genocides, the mass graves that exist on every continent have flown open and the ghosts have begun to tell their tales, comparing notes. This is what Benjamin wanted for us, to see the connections between traumatic events, to identify the underlying supremacist logics at work, to recognize patterns, to remember history, put its shattered pieces back together, tell the long suppressed alternate story. So of course this moment is wrenching, and of course we are fighting over words and chants. The Nazi Holocaust is finally being placed in history, connected to the terrors that came before and after. It is possible to get out of this endlessly recurring genocide loop. It is not too late to learn the lessons our predecessors failed to learn. Not too late to stop upping the ante with ever more powerful weapons and with stakes that are now planetary in scale. But it begins with telling the truth. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the weaponization of anti-Semitism used to suppress pro-Palestine that we've seen across college campuses, including on our own, and how this weaponization is a part of that first story of the Holocaust that you mentioned.
What I got into it in the talk was this collapsing of time that happens, right? Where you have this suturing together of the Holocaust with October 7th as if there's this one continuous event, one continuous Holocaust, as if 8 centuries don't separate them. I think this relates to the previous question around why exceptionalism is so important to Zionism, why Jews must be exceptionally hated. There's always a conflict of interest, I think. If a state supposedly needs to exist in order to keep Jews safe, and you know, one of the most disgraceful things that has happened in this period has been the repeating of this line by Joe Biden and other US politicians that if Israel didn't exist, no Jew in the world would be safe, right? So this is the story. That is Israel's Staatsraison, right? And it is, right, to keep Jews safe from the primordial and ever-present threat of genocide. Then the last thing that you want is for Jews to be safe. Like, the last thing you want is to actually throw down in multiracial, multiethnic, anti-racist coalitions to try to get at the root of really, you know, and this is, I think, the importance of what I'm calling story two, is that it's about getting to the logics, right? It's not just looking at, like, extracting from the Holocaust a rule, which is, you know, anti-Semitism is wrong and we have to fight it whenever it rears its head, but understanding what this logic of creating an inside group and an outside group, one group putting itself higher than another group and using that as an excuse to pillage lands, you know, and resources, that is pretty much always going to end in some kind of bloody mess and very likely genocide. So it isn't that exceptional. You know, I'm not saying that there isn't anti-Semitism on campus. I think there is a surge of many different forms of hatred right now, anti-Palestinian, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism, and this always happens whenever there is a surge of Israeli violence. It's really hard for, I think, people to pry apart because you have a state that is acting in the name of Jews, right? It is saying it is a Jewish state. But we still have a responsibility to say, actually, you don't represent Jews, and to make very careful distinctions and fight anti-Semitism along with anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia and all other forms of hatreds in our movements here. Well, mainly because it's the right thing to do, and we should be guided by principles. If you're anti-Zionist, it's also a great way to drain Zionism of some of its power, because its main argument is that Jew hatred is eternal, and they always seize, I mean, it's why there's sort of this constant inflation of this idea that U.S. campuses are incredibly unsafe for Jews and so on. That all feeds the Zionist story, right? As long as Jews are not safe in the diaspora, that's why you need a fortress ethno-state. So that is the way anti-Semitism has always been weaponized by Zionism. And I think we're in a moment where Israel, because it is committing mass crimes in broad daylight, needs to, you double down on that rationale for its own existence. So if we're seeing more weaponization of it, I think that's probably why. But we still need to be very vigilant about it. And just because it is weaponized doesn't mean we don't have to worry about it, if you know what I mean. I think that that's one of the dangers of having it distorted and weaponized, is that then we can just kind of shrug our shoulders and say it's not an issue. And nothing is a bigger gift to fascist forces who are all aligned with Zionists right now, whether it's Marine Le Pen or Giorgio Meloni or Viktor Orban. You know, it's a gift for them to be able to say, you see what's happening over here? That's why it's a special kind of hatred. It's particularly strong on the left. Ergo, this state must exist as a supremacist state.
You talked a lot about Holocaust exceptionalism, and in the world we're in, where this like hegemonic view of what anti-Semitism is what is codified and what is like structurally in power. How can we as like students on campus combat that? How do we create a viable alternative to this world? Especially like you mentioned going to Jewish day school, a lot of Jewish communities are bent towards this like Israel vision. A lot of Jewish communities have these definitions of anti-Semitism that are so deeply codified within them. How do we combat that hegemonic story when people are like so caught up in that?
I mean, honestly, I think you've been doing it, and I think that that is why campuses have been the sites of such extreme repression and investigation, and I think what deserves to be called a new McCarthyism, and I say that as the granddaughter of somebody who was blacklisted during the McCarthy years, and I think it's driven by a real fear that campuses are places, they're not the only places, but they're places where meaning is made, where people get their worldviews, and they also get their worldviews changed and challenged. And the polling on generational shifts among Jews is terrifying. Their elders and the legacy Jewish organizations who are watching as their kids join, JVP, and if not now, and ask very deep questions about whether or not they had got a Holocaust education or an indoctrination or, these rituals of re-traumatization. You mentioned the museums. One of the things that really strikes me and that I think is a really important part of trying to understand where we are is that a lot of what passed as Holocaust remembrance was actually re-traumatization. And the reason it was re-traumatization is because the Holocaust was being instrumentalized to turn us, I don't know about you, but me, into Zionists, right? It was a plot point in a larger story. Like, let's not let the weaponization drain away the horror, the horror of it. But then immediately it pivots to, therefore, Zionism. If you're stuck in a trauma loop, one of the ways you know you're stuck in it is that time collapses, right? So I was talking before about this sort of confusion of like, is it still 80 years ago? What Holocaust, or was it a very bloody, anti-colonial uprising? And the discourse was immediately to suture it onto the Holocaust and to call it the bloodiest day in Jewish history since the Holocaust and so on. So collapsing time and space. This is a symptom of trauma. This is why I say this is a miseducation. This is the opposite of leadership, tries to keep people in a traumatized state, tries to re-inscribe the trauma in future generations. It isn't a natural occurrence that people who never experienced that trauma firsthand would feel as if they do. That was inscribed. That's what's being called an education. It's not an education. It is re-traumatization, and it's instrumentalization, and has a very clear political goal. I think many young people are now understanding this. I think it is terrifying their elders, who sent them on their birthright trips and March of the Living trips, and it's starting to break down. And so you're asking, what do we do? That's why it is so important that you experience feelings of safety with one another. It's why it matters how you treat each other, It matters if people get a body knowledge of something else, whether that's friendships and relationships on campus, a revolutionary spirit, real solidarity, that actually matters. Yeah, that helps. Not to sound too maternal here, but you are up against very serious forces. You're up against a two-party system that is trying to crush this. You're going to be told that you're bringing back Donald Trump, all of it. And you really, all that you really have are one another in your movements, right? You're not going to get a pat on the head for any of this activism, right? The urgency to build cultures within movements that can sustain you so that people don't burn out and feel really unsafe within movements is incredibly important because, your activism, even though you've experienced unbelievable pushback, it's nothing compared to what Palestinians are facing right now as we speak. So yeah, you're getting pushback, and it's that old story, pushing back. Of course it is. But you're telling the story now. You're telling it. So take care of each other and find solidarity and show that You don't need an ethnostate, and nobody gets an ethnostate, because you can keep each other safe. Thank you.
You were just listening to Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning. She spoke at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, in mid-April 2024. Naomi Klein teaches at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. An award-winning author, her latest book is Doppelganger. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, unembedded nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Vijay Prashad, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Naomi Klein, Holocaust and Historical Reckoning, and her book, Doppelganger, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.